it brings me no pleasure to report that bad arguments against materialism are being made in the press. I come across bad arguments for materialism everywhere on the internet, and I rarely see physicalists police their own. But what kind of hypocrite would I be if I didn't do the same that I ask of them? So, inspired by Ralph Stefan Weir's excellent piece on this, we're going to be breaking down the increasingly popular argument from terminal lucidity. I don't know of any formal statement of the argument. It's something I've only come across in books and articles that were not written by philosophers of mind. For example, Dale Allison's wonderful book, Encountering Mystery. What ignited this recent round of responses and counter-responses was Charles Murray's op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, "Can Science Reckon with the Human Soul? A paradigm shift is coming as evidence emerges that we are more than our brains." Murray describes terminal lucidity as, quote, "a sudden temporary return to self-awareness, memory, and lucid communication by a person whose brain is no longer functional, usually because of advanced dementia, but occasionally because of meningitis, brain tumors, strokes, or chronic psychiatric disorders." Terminal lucidity can last from a few minutes to a few hours. In the most dramatic cases, people who have been unable to communicate or even recognize their spouses or children for years suddenly become alert and exhibit their former personalities. It's almost always followed by complete mental relapse and death within a day or two. The phenomenon didn't have a name until 2009, but case studies reach back to detailed clinical descriptions from the 19th century. At face value, this seems like a problem for materialism. The brain and the mind are supposed to be in lockstep, with the activity of one's inner life faithfully correlated with the activity of the brain. As the brain deteriorates, so does consciousness. But terminal lucidity seems to be a counterexample. As psychologist Alexander Battiani explains, the intricate coordination of neural circuits is exactly what widespread cortical and hippocampal atrophy destroys in advanced dementia. If these systems are irreversibly degraded, we wouldn't expect terminal lucidity to occur. Yet it does. To account for terminal lucidity, one would need to show how patients with profound, long-term cognitive silence suddenly regain autobiographical memory, fluent speech, emotional nuance, and recognition. These aren't flickers of arousal or wishful misreadings. They are complex, integrated behavior. From an evolutionary standpoint, it's puzzling that a functionally rich, high-energy cognitive state would emerge only at the threshold of death, when it offers no adaptive advantage. If it could happen, why not earlier, when it might help survival, caregiving, or bonding? End quote. Murray dismisses the materialist promissory note of a future account of terminal lucidity, claiming that a strict materialist explanation must posit a so far unknown capability of the brain, and that the discovery of such a capability would, quote, "be akin to finding a way that blood can circulate when the heart stops pumping." He adds, quote, "I see the strict materialist view of consciousness as being in roughly the same fix as Newtonian physics was in 1887, when the Michelson-Morley experiment proved that the speed of light doesn't behave as Newton's laws said it should. It took 18 years before Einstein's theory of special relativity accommodated the anomaly." So far, the argument sounds pretty good. Evidence of consciousness persisting despite the destruction of the brain does suggest an immaterial factor at work. Battiani writes, quote, "Terminal lucidity may or may not support dualist interpretations, but it clearly challenges the assumption that consciousness in dementia vanishes in lockstep with brain deterioration. Serious anomalies demand serious inquiry, not reflexive rejection." There have been a number of responses to Murray, including from Steven Pinker and Michael Shermer. Jerry Coyne also contributed some angry babbling on his blog. But it isn't just materialists who are criticizing the argument. Author of The Mind-Body Problem in Metaphysics and former guest, Ralph Stefan Weir, had this to say. "As a philosopher who specializes in the mind-body problem, I agree that materialism is less plausible than many suppose, and that its traditional rival, mind-body dualism, should be taken seriously. So I welcome Murray's willingness to reopen the question, but I do not find the evidence he gives persuasive." In his argument, Murray invokes a powerful analogy. Explaining terminal lucidity through an unknown brain capability would be akin to finding a way that blood can circulate when the heart stops pumping. But as Weir points out, there's an important way in which these cases are disanalogous. We know a lot more about the heart than we know about the brain. If circulation continued as usual after your heart stopped pumping, that would be insane. That's because we have a satisfying reductionist account of how circulation works, but we don't have anything approaching that level of understanding when it comes to consciousness in the brain. Quote, "Murray appears to overestimate how far neuroscience has advanced. He states that The brain has been mapped for years. In fact, scientists have only lately produced a detailed map of a fruit fly's brain. We are a very long way from doing the same for humans. The fruit fly brain contains 140,000 neurons. The human brain has 86 billion. The difference in number between the neurons in a fruit fly brain and a human's is, therefore, approximately 86 billion. Our limited understanding of the brain is a problem for anyone who wants to use neuroscience to argue in favor of materialism. But it also undercuts Murray's case against materialism. If some so far unknown capability of the brain is needed to explain terminal lucidity, then such a capability may well be there just waiting to be discovered. Steven Pinker takes a similar line in his response to Murray. Quote, Murray's soul of the gaps argument, there's something we don't understand, therefore the soul did it, is extraordinarily weak. The human brain, with its 86 billion neurons and 100 trillion connections, is the most complex object in the known universe. No neuroscientist claims we understand its workings. Memory and intelligence are distributed across noisy, redundant circuits, which excite and inhibit each other in intricate networks and feedback loops. If one circuit deteriorates, another circuit it suppresses can rebound, including long dormant copies. Many unpredictable eruptions of activity are possible. I've heard a few skeptics use that soul of the gaps line before, and it's a bit ironic because they themselves are offering a promissory note that someday, somehow, materialism will explain this. In an uncharitable mood, someone might call that materialism of the gaps. We don't know how this works, therefore an unknown brain process did it. But how could you know that ahead of time, prior to investigation? Terminal lucidity has only gained mainstream attention in the past few years, so you didn't know what it was 10 seconds ago, but you're already extremely confident that an unknown brain process is responsible? Nonetheless, it is a fact that we know very little about the brain. As Pinker writes, contra Murray, these dynamics are nowhere near being understood by neuroscientists, since they may be the most complex phenomena in the universe. Yet we can be sure that with 86 billion neurons and a trillion synapses, the brain has enough physical complexity to challenge us with puzzles and surprises, none of them requiring a ghost in the machine. Well, until that last line, I was on board. It's a profoundly unscientific attitude to declare that you already know the answer ahead of time, even as you're admitting you don't know what the answer is. Neither Murray nor Pinker seem to recognize that the uncertainty cuts both ways. As Weir said, quote, our limited understanding of the brain is a problem for anyone who wants to use neuroscience to argue in favor of materialism, but it also undercuts Murray's case against materialism. We don't understand the brain as well as we understand the heart, so we shouldn't be so quick to say that we know what it can or cannot do. In fairness, Murray sort of anticipated this point. He grumpily responded to Pinker, quote, I wrote that explaining terminal lucidity through an unknown brain capability would be akin to finding a way that the blood can circulate when the heart stops pumping. The basis for that analogy is the profound neuronal atrophy and loss associated with advanced dementia. Mr. Pinker invokes the complexity of the brain and how much we still don't know about it. He doesn't acknowledge that advanced dementia destroys the networks for memory, speech, and self-recognition. Okay, so that's a relevant detail. Dementia destroys the parts of the brain associated with memory, speech, and self-recognition, which lends some credibility to Murray's heart analogy. But the problem, once again, is that Murray seems to overestimate our knowledge of the brain and its disorders. As Weir explains, quote, Murray's claim that terminal lucidity refutes materialism rests on a questionable presupposition. It assumes that on a materialist explanation, dementia and brain damage must operate by permanently destroying the neural structures responsible for memory, personality, and coherent thought. If that were the only materialist perspective available, then the return of lucidity would indeed seem to suggest some immaterial factor. But it is plausible that dementia involves not the annihilation of relevant neural structures, but their disruption. The circuits underlying clear thought and memory may still exist, but be kept from their normal function. The problem might lie in depleted neurotransmitters, the chemicals that carry signals from one neuron to another, or dulled sensitivity of neurons to those chemicals, or the pathological overactivity of inhibitory neurons that dampen communication across relevant regions of the brain. Such conditions would suppress lucidity without erasing its physical basis. So we can split up the possible accounts of the outward symptoms of these patients into different explanations: destruction and disruption, or some combination of the two. We can further subdivide disruption into different categories as well, since there's not just one theory of how disruption without destruction could occur. As Weir rightly says, if these networks are permanently destroyed, then it might make sense to invoke an immaterial aspect of the conscious mind. But neuroscientists haven't ruled out the other options. There's a lot we don't know about dementia. How confident can we be that the relevant neural structures are permanently destroyed? Although this point aids the materialist defense, materialists should be a little nervous about the fact that they're a hostage to fortune and need to root against the destruction option. If it turns out that the relevant neural structures are annihilated in these patients who experience terminal lucidity, then people like Murray are actually onto something. But, for now, that would go beyond what we know. It's worth repeating that not every case of terminal lucidity is from a patient with dementia. There are also cases of meningitis, brain tumors, some who've suffered strokes. I assume the destruction option will be more plausible in some cases than others, but say we did obtain great evidence for destruction over disruption, which prima facie would be a problem for materialism. The thing is, the materialism of the gaps argument is still gonna look pretty tempting. We simply can't make arguments like Murray's with a high degree of confidence at this stage when we're so ignorant of the complex workings of the human brain. As Weir concludes, quote, "It may be that terminal lucidity will eventually prove beyond neuroscientific explanation. For my part, I think that scientists have been much too quick to dismiss the possibility that consciousness might involve some non-physical aspect of reality. But terminal lucidity does not establish that conclusion." So, a question I often have for dualists is whether the soul is the seat of psychological properties. Our ignorance of the brain is enough to undercut the argument from terminal lucidity, at least tentatively, but I also worry that invoking the soul to explain terminal lucidity may raise further problems that don't have an easy resolution. In my dualist moods, I usually think the soul is not the seat of one's psychological profile. Subjectivity is what I think materialism can't explain, not personality traits. But if an immaterial soul is the right account of terminal lucidity, then that seems to imply that your psychological profile is properly located in the soul. Your memories, your personality, your dispositions, and so on have their ultimate basis in the immaterial mind, which, I suppose, transmits information to the brain like a signal to a receiver. On this view, the deterioration of the brain distorts the signal and inhibits its reception, rather than altering the signal itself. Say that's all true. In that case, how does terminal lucidity work exactly? For months or years, the brain has not been properly receiving the transmissions of the soul, and then the soul suddenly, what, overpowers the brain? Why couldn't it do that before? If the relevant neural networks have been destroyed, then their destruction was apparently a big problem for the soul until one day when it wasn't. What changed? What caused their episode of lucidity? You might think, well, I don't know how it works, but if the physical brain has been irreparably damaged, what other explanation is there? It can't be something material, so it must be something immaterial. And that's fair enough, but let's think through this option a bit more. If the soul is the real seat of one's psychological attributes, then we're faced with a choice. Either the psyche is not affected by the brain's degeneration, or it is. Obviously, this is not binary. There can be degrees of damage. Further, maybe not all psychological traits are equally affected by neurological disorder. For example, maybe memory is affected to a greater degree than one's dispositions to behave in certain ways, or vice versa. So why raise this question? Well, the dualist position by itself doesn't commit one to a particular view about whether various psychological and cognitive functions require just the body, just the soul, or both body and soul. But if the soul is invoked to explain terminal lucidity, you're going to be pushed off the fence. In order for the lucidity argument for dualism to work, we have to say that the soul is unaffected by the brain's degeneration, right? So back to that fork in the road. Either the psyche, that is, the psychological properties relevant to terminal lucidity, the psyche is not affected by the brain's degeneration, or it is. If it's not affected by the decay of the brain, does that mean that these patients all along were trapped in a body they couldn't control, fully aware but unable to speak or interact with others? That's terrifying. I mean, a lot of people are comforted by the idea of terminal lucidity, but I don't find that particular idea comforting at all. Thankfully, there's not much reason to think that dementia patients are living in a hellish, locked-in scenario. As far as I know, those who live with or work with dementia patients tend to think that there's still some fractured piece of them there. They're just a diminished version of their former self. I don't believe these patients are fully cognizant, but simply unable to control their bodies. Besides, if that were the case, then when lucidity takes hold, wouldn't you expect some of them to start screaming, "Oh my god, I've been locked in for the past 2 years?" Needless to say, I'm skeptical of the view that their psychological profile remained fully intact all along. It doesn't really seem like that's what's going on with these patients, and to my knowledge, none of them in their lucidity have reported this to be the case. Further, it's unclear why the soul would suddenly be able to override the brain. I mean, what's supposed to have caused the change? According to Murray, the relevant parts of the brain were destroyed, but the soul wasn't. That's why terminal lucidity is supposed to be supportive of the soul. But that raises the question, why did the psychological changes that preceded the lucidity happen in the first place? Were those changes illusory? Setting aside the idea that these patients' minds are fully intact, locked inside an uncooperative body, let's think about the alternative. Say that their psychological profile was indeed shattered. After all, dualists believe that the mind and body are intimately intertwined. The corruption of the brain will also corrupt the mind. In that case, why does the mind become intact once again near the point of death? The brain hasn't changed, so why the sudden change in mental functioning? If you maintain that the soul was unaffected by the brain's ailments, then you're back to the first option. But if you say the soul is constrained by the brain's functioning and will always march in accordance with neural activity, then you've undermined your ability to explain terminal lucidity. The whole point is that the soul can continue on its merry way even with the brain severely damaged. Neither option, intact or shattered, looks especially promising, although there may be modifications that I haven't thought of that could rescue them. It seems as though the dualist should want to say that the psyche was affected by the brain's degeneration for a period of time, but prior to death, it somehow became unburdened and unconstrained by the brain damage. Maybe it's the process of disembodiment that causes these profound changes. But my original question to the defenders of the lucidity argument was whether the soul is the source of psychological properties, and the answer is not really coming into focus. At least on the surface, there appears to be a dilemma here. If the soul is responsible for our psychological attributes, memories, etc., then we should expect these patients to be living in a nightmarish, locked-in scenario. But that seems implausible. On the other hand, if the brain is responsible for our psychological properties, then we've sawn off the branch that we're sitting on. The whole point of the lucidity argument is that the material brain has decayed, and yet these psychological attributes reappear, despite that fact, suggesting they have their basis in the immaterial mind. Of course, the dualist position by itself doesn't commit one to a particular view about whether various cognitive functions require just the body, just the soul, or both body and soul. But the defenders of the argument seem to be committing themselves to the both body and soul option, since they need to account for the patient's end-of-life lucidity and the psychological changes during their illness. So, what is the division of labor exactly between the body and soul with respect to cognitive functioning? More to the point, what version of dualism can account for both terminal lucidity and the period of time preceding it? Are some memories stored in the soul, others in the brain? Are they stored in the soul with the brain playing some other role in recollection? What's the division of labor? And what on earth happens prior to death that causes terminal lucidity? Maybe these questions have satisfying answers, but it seems like the soul is a bad explanation here. At first, it looks like the only good explanation on offer, but I think it raises questions that are not easily resolved. As I mentioned, when I have my dualist hat on, or my dualist crown, rather, I usually don't think the soul is the seat of psychological properties. I tend not to think that one's memories are stored in the soul, for instance. It's not impossible, but I would need some wise dualist to untangle these knots for me. Unfortunately, many arguments of this genre seem to imply that they are. Memories of past lives, NDEs in which one returns to a place they feel they've been before, certain ghost encounters, and terminal lucidity. These sorts of arguments tend to imply that the soul is responsible for a far greater share of our cognition than some dualists would otherwise be inclined to think. Of course, if those arguments work, then I'd just have to change my view. I'd need to construct a working theory as to how the brain and mind work in concert. Regardless, I assume we all agree that it's implausible that these patients' minds are fully intact, locked inside a decaying and uncooperative body. Doesn't really seem like that's what's going on in these cases. And to my knowledge, none of these patients in their lucidity have reported it to be the case. Further, it's unclear why the soul would suddenly be able to override the brain. But if one's psychological profile is broken by their malfunctioning brain, as outwardly appears to be the case, then it's unclear why the soul suddenly reconstitutes the psyche fully intact, but only for a short window immediately prior to death. So, I don't think what I'm offering is a knockdown argument. Maybe there's a way out of the maze, but for me, these issues do instill some caution. If dualists want to appeal to NDEs, past life memories, encounters with disembodied minds, and terminal lucidity, they need to explain the relations between psychological properties, the brain, and the soul. Murray's op-ed incited the Skeptic Brigade, and unsurprisingly, much of their bluster didn't amount to anything. Earlier, I very charitably cut out 80% of what Steven Pinker said, since we were only talking about good responses to the argument. Jerry Coyne also weighed in with his characteristic humility and dispassionate rationality. Michael Shermer very ambitiously tried to explain terminal lucidity by dehydration. Yes, that sounds like a stretch, but we can't dismiss it out of hand. It's at least testable. I guess we just need to severely dehydrate dementia patients and see what happens. I admit I would be surprised if the effects were comparable to those reported in terminal lucidity, but it's not the kind of question you can know the answer to a priori. Steven Pinker offered three objections to terminal lucidity. One, we don't really understand the brain well enough to make the argument. Two, the notion of a soul is incoherent. And three, it is doubtful that terminal lucidity is a real phenomenon in the first place. We already talked about one, so let's talk about the other two. First, why does Pinker doubt the reports of terminal lucidity? Claims of quote-unquote terminal lucidity consist of subjective recollections by loved ones and caregivers, but we know that people are extraordinarily credulous about the cognitive abilities of entities they interact with, readily overinterpreting simple responses as signs of non-existent cognition. The first primitive chatbot, Eliza, simulated a therapist in the 1960s using a few dozen canned responses. For example, "Tell me more about your mother." Yet, people poured their hearts out to it. With so-called facilitated communication, therapists and patients were convinced they were liberating the trapped thoughts of profoundly autistic children with the use of a keyboard, oblivious to the fact that they were manipulating the children's hands. When there's desperation to commune with a loved one, any glimmer of responsiveness can be interpreted as lucidity, exaggerated with each recall and retelling. What Murray did not report was any objective indicator of coherence or lucidity like an IQ test, or a standard bedside neurological battery, or a quiz of autobiographical memory with verifiable details. End quote. I personally would not recommend giving your dying mom an IQ test in hospice. Seriously, though, it is surprising to me the lengths that skeptics will go to avoid admitting that something weird exists. Flatly denying the phenomenon is a cherished tradition among skeptics, but you'd have to just ignore the reports of terminal lucidity to think this response works. And he basically does. He implies that the stories are all exaggerated and embellished over time, but many of these cases involve patients, quote, who have been unable to communicate or even recognize their spouses or children for years and suddenly become alert and exhibit their former personalities. As Murray responded, quote, "Mr. Pinker ignores that, describing the evidence as anecdotes. All Mr. Pinker had to do was get the Kindle version of Batiane's Threshold and spend an hour scanning it so he could report whether the cases meeting my criteria exist." Batiane, the author of the book Murray cites, weighed in as well. Quote, "Charles Murray doesn't need my help debating Steven Pinker, but as the author of the principal book on terminal lucidity, I offer a few observations. Contrary to Mr. Pinker, grieving relatives aren't the only ones reporting cases of terminal lucidity. In the international study I led, many instances were corroborated by physicians, nurses, or hospice staff. Our findings are consistent with a 2024 scoping review compiling dozens of clinical reports and with Sandy McLeod's 2009 prospective study. These stories aren't sentimental hogwash, they are clinical observations from structured care environments." End quote. Pinker also asserts that the notion of the soul is incoherent, which kind of makes the other arguments unnecessary. Quote, "A great irony in the attempt to use rigorous scientific reasoning to support some theory of an immaterial soul is that the theory itself, inevitably left unspecified, is utterly incoherent. If a Dybbuk can re-enter a ravaged brain as a gift to loved ones longing for a last goodbye, why are just a few people blessed with this miracle rather than everyone? Why can't the soul just stay put, making everyone immortal?" Why would that make you immortal? Do you think dualism is the view that the physical body doesn't decay? So no one knows the cause of terminal lucidity, and dualists don't pretend to know why it happens. Characterizing it as a gift saddles the dualist with extra commitments that conveniently make their view seem less reasonable. And he continues his barrage of rhetorical questions, but none of them come close to establishing his initial claim. Dr. Weir and I spoke about dualism for over 3 hours, and about his book, The Mind-Body Problem and Metaphysics, and I would truly be at a loss if anyone read chapters 2 and 3 and thought his Aristotelian-Cartesian independence definition of substance was incoherent. Pinker also says the notion of an immaterial soul is inevitably left unspecified. Setting aside the detail that what Pinker says is demonstrably false, even on his own terms, does he think he's making the case that dualism is incoherent or contradictory or meaningless when he asks, why can't the soul just stay put, making everyone immortal? Like, in his mind, did he succeed at what he set out to do? The words of physicalist Daniel Stoljar come to mind. Quote, "We live in an overwhelmingly physicalist or materialist intellectual culture. The result is that, as things currently stand, the standards of argumentation required to persuade someone of the truth of physicalism are much lower than the standards required to persuade someone of its negation." Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.